broadcasting around the world on international shortwave and on the Radio Disclosure Radio Network. I'm your host tonight, Matt Aaron. And we've got a show for you. We've talked to the guy up in Michigan that was sending RF out into space, and he was trying to contact aliens. And my understanding is that's a hot spot. And we've got a guy that's up in central Michigan. I don't know if he's going to exactly talk about nothing but central Michigan, but it's going to be interesting, I guess would be the way to say it. I want to welcome Steve Ward to the program. Hi, Steve. How are you this wonderful evening?
Great to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, you're quite welcome. Folks, the number is 1-833-880-9899, 1-833-880-9899 if you want to join us. Steve, before we get too far into things, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you're from, and how long have you been doing this research?
Well, I'm a retired gentleman. I was in the electrical wholesale field for quite a few years. But this kind of started for me now. A lot of people you talk to are probably experiencers. You may be one yourself. But I've never really been much of an experiencer. I had one kind of bizarre event, I guess, happen to me. But I was enthralled by the books of Frank Edwards. I don't know if you remember those or not. There were these great anthologies you could buy back in the 60s. And they were like Stranger Than Science, Strange World. And he eventually wrote Flying Saucer Serious Business, which became a very big bestseller. And that coincided with the 1966 March sightings in Michigan and other parts of the Midwest of a wave of UFOs. And that's when Dr. J. Allen Hynek came in and called some of them swamp gas. And of course, that name stuck forever. But Edward started me off. He talked about things like the Flatwoods Monster, the Kelly Hopkinsville Goblins. He had a lot of spooky ghost stories, too, which I was not interested in at the time. And he even talked a little bit about Bigfoot. He had a chapter in one of them called The Monster Apes of Oregon.
Wow.
And I was in junior high when these wave of sightings hit in March 1966. And there were a lot of credible witnesses, police officers and so forth. And this stuff was, I grew up in the Detroit area, just north of Detroit. And this stuff was almost in my backyard. Of course, I wasn't able to drive, so I couldn't play UFO investigator. But, this stuff was being covered on the newspapers and the news. And then the following November, the same year, was one of the first major Mothman sightings that occurred in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where this winged humanoid with red glowing eyes chased two couples down Route 62 north of Point Pleasant. So I think those events in the year 1966 really pretty much cemented my interest for the rest of my life.
Interesting. So you've been researching this since you've been a little kid, is kind of what you're getting at here.
Right.
And you yourself, you say, have not had any or few experiences.
I've only had one odd experience. And strangely enough, it was in the Point Pleasant area. Some years ago,
Hold on just a second. Point Pleasant, and I just want to make sure that people hear this right. I think, isn't that a suburb of Detroit?
No.
Okay, I'm wrong.
Actually, Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Gotcha. My apologies.
And it was connected by the Silver Bridge to Gallipolis, Ohio. And the Silver Bridge collapsed after a year of strange incidents in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. The first major Mothman sighting was seen November 15th, 1966. The bridge collapsed December 15th, 1967. And I'm so used to saying Point Pleasant, I forget to say that it's in West Virginia because I go down there so often. The Route 62 is the two-lane where two couples, they saw this sort of a winged humanoid with red glowing eyes in what they call the old TNT area. Now, this it's now called the McClintic Wildlife Area. Back around World War II, if you look at the old black and white photographs, it was a huge complex where they made munitions for the war effort. And but by the mid-60s, it was a it was just all overgrown and a ruin. And they saw this thing by the old North Power Plant, which has been since been torn down. Well, I went out there one night. There's a whole series of, it was 100, they call them igloos or concrete bunkers, where they used to store these munitions. And some of them were sold to private interests. People store stuff in them. Some are open, and people do get to EVP work in there and so forth. People have had paranormal experiences and seen shadow people. I went out there one night alone just to see if I could do it. I mean, it's no big deal for the locals. They camp and hunt and fish out there. And as I was driving back, I experienced a couple flashes of light, like a strobe. And it might have been something very mundane, but I just didn't have the presence of mind to think, where in the road was this? And maybe I could come back and check the next day. Well, I got to my motel, which was across the river in Gallipolis, and opened the door, and the TV set turned on by itself and started flipping through channels steadily. Oh, now, this never, stuff like this never happens to me. So it really took me a bit by surprise. I have no explanation. I unplugged the TV set, and fortunately it stopped flipping channels. But and then the next year, some friends of mine and I were in the room next to that one, and the TV set started acting up a little bit, not as much as it did that time before, the year before. And the next day it acted up a bit. And then it would turn on and flip through a couple stations and stop. And we, of course, then we got a remote, and we were trying to make it work through walls or to see if we could have any explanation as to what it was doing. A few years later, at a Mothman festival, in the next room, this is all the same corner of this motel, there's a bigger room where two couples that I know were staying. They had a more modern TV that they were watching, and they were having trouble with the volume. The volume kept getting quieter and quieter. They would keep turning it up, then all of a sudden it would blast, and they'd go through the whole process again. And then all of a sudden a beverage can, something that was on a nightstand, flew off the nightstand and hit the floor. So I have no idea what's going on in that corner of that motel, starting in about, I think it was 2011 or 2012 when I first had my experience. So fortunately, whoever's there is still flipping channels and did not come home with me.
Oh, that's, you know, that has got to be one of the scariest things, is when you experience something that changes your physical environment around you to where you just, it's just, yeah, that. So, Mothman, and I know you were talking about the Mothman Festival that's coming up soon. My understanding is you know a lot about Mothman. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I have followed I have followed Mothman since November of 1966.
So when we come back from the break, Steve, I want to talk more about Mothman. We actually had another individual that was on the show not too long ago that says that Mothman saved his life, but also cautioned people that Mothman is dangerous. Told a creepy story of car flipping, all kinds of crazy stuff. Oof. More of this when we come back. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. Talking with Steve Ward. All kinds of crazy tonight. Going to hit up a little bit more about Mothman. He's been studying it, what did you say, since 1960-something?
Well, that's when I first heard about it. And, of course, it was John Keel who wrote the Mothman Prophecies. The Mothman Prophecies didn't come out till about 10 years after the events. But he did write about it occasionally in some of the periodicals, like the Flying Saucer Review, and Saga Magazine used to have Saga's UFO Report. So we would get, you know, some elements of it.
Now, hold on, Steve. Yes. I'm going to back up for a second. Okay. There's a lot of people that have never heard of Mothman. I've only talked to two or three people, I mean, that prior to doing this show that have maybe, and I saw it in the weekly world news, like, you know, that just sounds, you know, but from my understanding from the other people that I've talked to after starting doing this show, that there's probably more than one Mothman. There's probably a race. And I'm trying to, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, what a lot of people don't understand is we're not maybe talking about one individual here. We're talking about a race. And I don't think people really realize what it is that you're actually saying when you say Mothman. And I'm trying to iterate that a little bit more before we get deeper into this.
Well, there's this majestic Mothman statue in the heart of Point Pleasant, very stylized. The reason it was dubbed Mothman, it had nothing to do with a moth. The descriptions didn't make it look like a moth. However, at the time, the Batman TV show was out, so some creative copy editor dubbed him Mothman. We don't know who, but it stuck somehow. And it was, from the descriptions, John Keel collected a little over 100 reports in that year. From that description, it was roughly 6-7 feet tall, a 10-foot wingspan. It didn't seem necessarily to have a head. It's almost like it was sunken down and the eyes were lower, perhaps in his chest or whatever. But the eyes were red, glowing eyes. They were sometimes they said they were sort of bat-like wings. But the Mothman, this thing was a paradox. I don't know if there was more than one or not. I know that I met Chip Coffey, the psychic, down there once at an event. He said that he thought there was four of them, and that was just his impression. When I say the Mothman was a paradox, it didn't act so much like a physical creature. People would see it when it would take off. It wouldn't necessarily flap its wings. Sometimes it would put its wings behind it and then take off straight like a helicopter. And when it was in flight, it didn't necessarily flap its wings. Also, a biologist would probably say that for something 6 or 7 foot tall, a 10-foot wingspan isn't quite enough to get it aloft. So there were some aspects of it that made it seem more like perhaps an apparition. But John Keel found a lot of very strange-looking footprints around the old North Power Plant in the TNT area and other places where this thing is supposed to have been. Interesting enough, he also found, this is back in 66, large dog-like footprints that he thought the thing had to be about, maybe 300 pounds with the depression in the ground. Now, when we hear about large dog-like footprints nowadays, we think of the dog man, the upright canids that have been reported all over, well, not just the Midwest, but Linda Godfrey wrote The Beast of Bray Road that was talking about strange sightings of this creature in near Elkhorn, Indiana. Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Forgive me, Wisconsin. So the thing is that when you get into this, Matt, you start at a point and it takes you all over the place. So it's just very interesting that, and there's other researchers that have said that they see these large dog-like footprints show up in these hot spots. But the Mothman was, a couple times it was seen in conjunction with a strange light. Some people thought it was an alien or whatever. I honestly don't know what it was. John Keel didn't know what it was. He used a term, as a literary device, he called them ultra-terrestrials. And it's a term that he borrowed from Ivan Sanderson. Now, Ivan Sanderson, for those that may not know, he was a British naturalist, transplanted to New Jersey. He's probably most famous for his book called The Abominable Snowman, Legend Come to Life. Hmm. But he also wrote great books on UFOs. But that's the, and all that ultra-terrestrial means is Keel was trying to come to grips with what these things were. He didn't necessarily think they were off-world. He thought perhaps they were a natural condition of this planet. So, again, it was just a literary device to try and hang a name on something. But the Mothman didn't hurt anybody, scared the hell out of a lot of people, chased cars. There was a professional individual who wasn't named in town that saw this thing. He was standing on his front porch. He saw it standing in his front yard. he zoned out. He had about 10 or 15 minutes missing time, and then the thing took off. Nobody knows what happened in that time. So, and also, the Mothman was seen in at that same time frame with all kinds of bizarre lights flying over Point Pleasant and that part of West Virginia and the Ohio Valley. So there were a lot of things going on at the same time. But it's very difficult, at least for me, to try and put Mothman in a category. Some people want to say he's some kind of a mutation or an interdimensional being or whatever. I don't know what it was, but I do know that we have to listen to what people report. I've actually spoken to about six of the original witnesses. Most of them saw the same thing. One man, Tom Urey, saw something at that same time period, much more like a thunderbird. The bird was something he couldn't identify. It had about a 10 or 12 foot wingspan, and this was in broad daylight. It does seem that when you get into these areas, these high strangeness areas, all kinds of things are going on at the same time. But John Keel arrived on the scene, and he thought he was just going to spend a day or two there. And as he said on an interview on TV once, it became almost like an occupation for him. Oh my. And so he chronicles these strange events in the Mothman Prophecies.
So as I sit back and I listen to all this, Mothman, the more that you just said, the more that you continue to talk about it, it's Dr. Stamey joined us. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a researcher, I think, in the Carolinas, if my memory serves me correctly. He told a story that there was a Mothman incident that wound up flipping a vehicle. Like, these entities were extremely strong, extremely dangerous, and not something to trifle with. That was the way that he described it. In the town and the city that this incident took place in, they all blamed the accident on Mothman. It's really strange. But anyways.
Well, some people believe that he was a harbinger. I mean, at the end of that year, of course, there were still other things going on, but the bulk of the sightings and so forth kind of tapered off then. A lot of people think he was a harbinger for the Silver Bridge collapse that December 15th, where 46 people lost their lives. I tend not to think that, but there's other people that think the Mothman is more akin to the Garuda out of Hindu mythology, more of a protector deity. And so I don't know where I stand on any of those. I just collect the reports and try to look for patterns.
Do you think there's any connection to Mothman in UFO incidents?
Just that... There were some times, a couple times, when people would not necessarily see a craft, but they saw a strange light in the sky about the same time. There's a lot of instances where cryptids and UFOs share the same stage. In 1973-74, Stan Gordon in Pennsylvania, this would be Southwest Pennsylvania, and this is chronicled in a book called Silent Invasion. There was a wave of really bizarre Bigfoot-type reports, but in conjunction with landed UFOs and strange lights in the sky. I guess there have even been, you can go back in history. You're familiar with the 1897 airship reports, these majestic dirigible-like airships that were seen all over the country. But there was a wave of them that were seen in Ohio between mid-April and mid-May. And the sightings kind of made a circuit around Ohio, lapsing a little bit into West Virginia. But at the same time, people were seeing this strange cat-like creature around Chillicothe. It had kind of an oversized head, short legs, very odd-looking. They couldn't shoot it or trap it. The proportions sound a little bit like some of the creatures mentioned in the infamous Skinwalker Ranch, the ranch out in Utah, where all these different things are supposed to have happened. We just had a TV show on it. There's a book called The Hunt for the Skinwalker, which chronicles a lot of that. But also, at the same time, these airships were going around in Adams County, where the Serpent Mound is located. People were seeing something they called a wild man or a gorilla, which nowadays we would have called a Bigfoot. So here we have, there's a lot of points throughout history where people are seeing cryptids and some kind of a strange atmospheric phenomenon. Let's put it that way. I know, to start down, I hate to use the expression of going down the rabbit hole. I don't just don't have a better one. But you start down there, you start at one point, and if you put it on a graph, it just stretches all over the place from the past to the present. And another thing that you get into is when you look at elements of folklore, like fairy folklore, the elementals or whatever, and compare them to modern day UFO reports, there are many, many patterns, many similarities. So it's very hard to just think of these things in terms of aliens from Alpha Centauri coming down here to collect soil samples.
Jeez. When we come back from the break, we're going to continue this conversation. Steve Ward is our guest. 1-833-880-9899. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. Steve Ward is our guest. If you want to join us, 1-833-880-9899. The question is, how deep does the rabbit hole go? It continues to go deeper and deeper and deeper as we continue to talk tonight. Steve, how can people find you online on... How can they, if they wanted to get in contact with you to talk about some of this stuff, if they wanted to give you information that you could even research, how do they get a hold of you?
Well, you can find me on Facebook under Steve Ward. If you type in Steve Ward and Battle Creek, Michigan, you'll probably find me okay in the midst of all the other Steve Wards. I do have a Facebook page called the Phantom Menagerie. And I also I'm a correspondent on a podcast called Mac Maloney's Military X-Files, which you can find, which is on weekly.
Nice. So, in current news, UFOs are a big deal, and everyone's gone UFO crazy and Bigfoot crazy all of a sudden. And I'll definitely say that I've talked to many different people. I talked to Dr. Ketchum and looked at her research and looked at all this. There is so much real evidence that there's something there. Now, am I going to call it the actual Bigfoot or whatever? My opinion doesn't matter. The facts matter. The sightings matter. The eyewitnesses matter. Not my opinion. And there's one story that in history that you just brought up during the break here, that as far as UFOs go, it's the pinnacle of what the crap, because I don't know. I'll let you describe the story. I think you've got an interesting take on it.
Well, the most interesting stuff people, I think, will find is what happened afterwards. But back in about 61, Betty and Barney Hill were returning from a vacation in Canada, traveling Route 3 in New Hampshire, and they saw a strange craft in the sky and realized when they got home that they were missing a couple hours of time. They were also having dreams. They were having a hard time adjusting. And it turned out that this was the first reported classic UFO abduction case. It's a long story, but they sought out Dr. Benjamin Simon, who put them under regressive hypnosis. And they both told essentially the same story, where they were stopped along the road. They were taken aboard a craft and examined on examining tables. And aliens that looked a little bit like what we think of grays these days, but not quite. And Betty had long conversations with them and supposedly saw a star map. And they had they were examined medically and so forth. And then... And that was it. So, but it took a long time several different hypnotic sessions for this to come out. And then finally, they were able to hear their tapes from Dr. Benjamin Simon. Those have actually been released. They were some years ago. I think Linda Moulton Howe got a hold of them. And there was a made for TV movie, which is, it may be hard to find, but it was done in the mid 70s. It was called The UFO Incident, based on this. And it was James Earl Jones played Barney. Estelle Parsons played Betty. It was extremely well done. They didn't just sensationalize the abduction part. We get into their life and their history and everything that was going on at that time. It's too bad that they don't remaster that and make it available again. But they continued to have very strange experiences afterwards. People that saw the Mothman, a lot of them afterwards had an outbreak of poltergeist phenomena in their homes. Sometimes people that see a UFO have an outbreak of poltergeist phenomena. They had all kinds, Betty and Barney Hill had all kinds of strange phenomena like that around the house, their clothes and everything, and things would be rearranged in the house. They would heard footsteps. They had classic haunting type phenomena in their homes. Now, some of the things that happened to them were, some seemed to be paranormal, but there were other things that were certainly due to human intervention. We've heard of men in black. Well, they were plagued by men in green. These guys in green coveralls would come at all hours of the day wanting to read her meter. And I thought, this is crazy. She finally checked it out and found out that the legitimate guys to come in and read the meter wore blue coveralls. So this undercover operation couldn't even get the color right. And one time they picked up their phone and they heard somebody talking about base intelligence. There were people around their house peeking in windows all the time. Some were probably just creeps. Some were probably some kind of a government intervention. But they had a lot of strange things happened. One was that was Betty's stepson. He was stationed in Panama. And every night at about 2 a.m. while he was on watch, a man all dressed in white that called himself Mr. Geist, ghost in German, who did not have a Panamanian accent. All he wanted to know was about what happened to his father and his stepmother aboard the craft. This happened on a few successive nights. When the brass found out, they wondered, who the hell is this guy? So they were asking Barney Jr. all these questions. I talked to Kathleen Marden, Betty's niece, and this is chronicled and captured by Kathleen Marden and Stanton Friedman. They had an incident. This is just one of many strange incidents where there was a gathering of Betty's family at somebody's house. And it looked like they could see through the curtains, a car pulled in the driveway. They could see the lights. It looked like some man got out, lit a cigarette, and they figured, oh, here we go, another reporter, right? So they waited and waited. Nothing happened. They go outside. There's nothing in the parking lot. They look across the street and they see this large orb of light moving away from them, and then eventually it disappears behind a garage across the street. Betty lost her earrings aboard when she had this incident. One day she came home, and on her kitchen table was a bunch of leaves and dirt, and her earrings sitting in the middle of this mess.
Oh, wow.
How the hell do you explain that? And then it gets really weird. The same gentleman...
It gets even weirder.
Oh, yes. Strap in for this one. The same gentleman that suggested they seek out regressive hypnosis said, Betty, you know, you seem to have a rapport with a certain one you call the leader aboard this craft. Perhaps we could try telepathic experiments. Maybe we could have them land again. So she would go out on her back porch every night at 9 o'clock, send out a telepathic request for them to come back. The thing is, they couldn't land where they are because it's too congested. So she requested that they land in Kingston, where her parents lived, and because there's a lot of nice open space there. Now, Betty and this group, they didn't really think they were going to hit pay dirt, but what does it cost, you know? Several weeks later, Betty's father calls her and says, Betty, you better get over here. So she came over, and he tells her, he says, now this is his sister-in-law he's talking about. She was a widow and has the same last name of Barrett. she was awakened one night by a light coming through her bedroom window about 2 or 3 in the morning. And she looks, but she's also hearing a knocking on the door, like a series of steady knocks and a pause, another knock. She looks outside and sees a classic UFO hovering over her backyard. Now, she did not answer the door. She had no idea of this crazy experiment.
Oh, my.
And then, so they thought, well, something happened. So Betty continued. And, you know, she had to correct them. It's like, hey, you know, you can get all the way from Zeta Reticuli, but you can't find the right damn address. I don't think she said that. And then now you see her parents were, I guess they agreed to this. So one night, all of a sudden, her mom wakes up hearing a steady knocking on the door. So, you know, I guess the aliens would have knocked on the door, say, hey, we're here. Can you call Betty? And it'd come on over and we'll have a chat. But she's terrified. She can't even move. She can't even wake up her husband. Finally, she wakes him up. They hear this just god-awful noise that vibrates the house. They forget all about aliens coming to visit. He runs downstairs to see if the furnace is blown up. Nothing is out of line. Everything's intact. And they did not answer the door. Okay. But their neighbor the next day said that they saw some kind of a craft hovering over their back lot that night.
Oh, dear.
Now, I wonder, you know, what was there really somebody there? Were the wrappings something more like a poltergeist? I mean, who knows? But it's just really bizarre when you think about the original contact. You see, that's another thing. John Keel, he had a great catchphrase. It was, ask the contactee, he meant experiencer, what they had for breakfast. Now, he didn't care whether they had post toasties or scrambled eggs. His point was, you need to find out all about the individual, all about their life, because it turns out that somebody that sees a UFO has an experience like that, or a cryptid, has had all kinds of things happen. And I have found that, whatever, that they have all kinds of different paranormal phenomena happen to them. If I was frozen in the 1960s thinking that the UFO problem was merely aliens from other planets, I never would have known to ask all these other questions. But I did talk to a lady in New Hampshire, actually, a few years ago, who she and her husband had missing time sitting on their front porch, and they saw some kind of a triangle-like craft come over. They went to bed, right back to bed. They didn't even think about how strange it was at the time. But before she even made a breakthrough with regressive hypnosis, I asked her a whole series of John Keel-style questions. And to make a long story short, she had seen shadow people in her house. Both her sons had seen orb phenomena. One of them saw them dancing outside his bedroom window. The other one saw one in the front room that came up to him, spun around, and then took off.
Oh, my.
They had typical haunting phenomena, electrical interference in the house. And then I said, this is going to sound like a strange question, but have you ever seen anything like a Bigfoot or some kind of a animal you couldn't identify?
When we come back from the break, we're going to continue this. It's all connected. All of it. It's interesting. Steve Warder's our guest. We'll be back. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. UFOs, Bigfoots, Mothman, strange lights in the skies, fairies. Steve Ward is our guest. 1-833-880-9899 is our number. Steve, you asked them the big question, have they ever seen anything like a Bigfoot? And what happened?
And of course, like I said, the reason was that people, individuals seem to, Keel felt they were, he used another kind of a literary device called the super spectrum. Certain people seem to be more tuned in and have these experiences. Well, she said, no, she didn't have any kind of experience like that. And then she stopped and she said, you know, my mother-in-law and sister-in-law saw something really strange near the property. And this thing was seen twice. They described something that looked like a black panther, but standing on two legs. Now, that was a new one, even on me. So And also they had, at one time they had a UFO group, a local group over there doing an investigation, and they live in a cul-de-sac, and a big black car came down the cul-de-sac with its windows blanked out. So you got the classic motif of the Men in Black as well. But, you know, so she had the whole nine yards. Later on, she did make a breakthrough and had kind of a classic abduction experience. But she said she took it with a grain of salt because these are not memories that she consciously remembers. It's what she hears herself say on the tape.
It's amazing. So you've got a couple things that you want the folks to know. One of the big ones is your show that you do. How can people find that? Where is it located?
The Paranormal UK Radio Network. I do the High Strangeness Factor. There's a lot of shows there. And it's you can download it on Spreaker, Spreaker. And I've got about 2 years worth of shows now, and it's on every 2 weeks, and we talk to a wide variety of people. And were we going to talk about the Mothman Festival now?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This is an interesting event coming up.
Every third weekend in September, the Mothman Festival, it lasts 2 days. The only thing, it doesn't cost any money. It has, at the State Theater, they have speakers going on for 2 days, all kinds of vendors. They have plenty of stuff for the kids, too, plenty of food and that sort of thing. But the street where the Mothman statue is where you'll find the vendors, the speakers that have their tables and so forth. The only thing that costs money is, on Saturday night, they have what they call a hayride in the TNT area. Now, the TNT area is creepy in the daytime. At night, it's really creepy. And there's three of us. I'm one of the tour guides, along Jeff Wamsley, who is the co-creator of the Mothman Festival and the curator of the Mothman Museum, which is phenomenally well done, and another young lady named Brittany Sayre. We all give the tours. People pay their $5 and line up. And we go deep into the TNT area, guaranteed flyover of the Mothman. And it's a little bit like a Halloween hayride, but you really don't need anything to have the creepy factor. But it's a great place to go to meet people, to talk about these things without being laughed at, and to meet celebrities and speakers that are really worth talking to.
So,
and it's right there on the Ohio River, right to in West Virginia. You've got the history, you've got the geography. It really has everything.
So it sounds like this is definitely something that a lot of people are going to attend. And if you're interested in it, folks, you need to get there. You need to get there early. Is there any hotels in the area for the people?
They may have to go a bit far away because there's one that the Low Hotel is right there in Point Pleasant, but the prices it's a little bit pricey. It's an old, very old hotel. There are several regular hotels or chain hotels across the river, but they get filled up too. So a lot of people have to drive a half hour away sometimes to get in there.
Oh, wow.
By this time, there's a lot of them, but you still might find something. And if you're close enough, you can just drive there for the day.
Is there a website for the Mothman Festival that people can find?
Yes. If you type in Mothman Festival, it might even be Mothman Lives. I'm not sure, but just Google Mothman Festival and you'll find it. They've already got speakers. I think Nick Redfern is going to be there, Ken Gerhard, and I'm not sure who else right now, but they're kind of regrouping from last year because they did skip last year.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put, it looks like I found it, a Mothman Festival 2021 update. Please stand by for announcements, live band, 5K. Looks like there's a lot of different things going on here for this. And I'm going to put this right up on our website so people can find it. They can get up there and figure out if they want to go to this. I honestly, I'd love to go. I'm looking right now at the TNT tours. Looks, ooh, wow, yeah, that definitely...
It's a blast.
Yeah, that definitely looks a little spooky there, if you're interested in that. So, we've got about 3 minutes left here. And what is it out of everything that you've investigated that you have found to be the strangest of the strange, that just is beyond anything that you could ever believe? And I will venture to ask this last part of this question. Has the most evidence and proof that you can sit there and say, yes, this is strange, but it's real?
I guess I would say that when you put it all together and you research sightings and experiences from 100 years ago, stuff that's going on now, and you put it all together with folklore and modern day UFO experiences, the thing that always surprises me is that you will find patterns and parallels where these things aren't just isolated events. These things are repeating, happening over and over again. John Keel called it that great phonograph in the sky. So I never cease to be amazed that, well, let me just give you an example. We're very familiar with missing time in UFO experiences. Well, that happened in fairy folklore as well. Somebody would have an encounter with the elementals, the fairies, and think a few minutes have gone by and the whole day had gone by. Instead of being whisked away to that unscheduled medical examination, you might be taken to an underground cavern or something like that. But there's even the descriptions of some of the so-called fairies, if you were to exchange their little green tunic and red cap for a silver set of coveralls, they look almost identical. That's another interesting thing we won't have time to get into, is the evolution of the entities throughout the past several decades, all the way from the past to what we call grays now. But that's the thing that surprises me the most, and makes it the most interesting, is that we can find patterns and parallels. But like you mentioned earlier, we have to listen to what people say and shake our preconceived notions about what this may be. Because I had certain notions in the 60s, which it can have been completely blown away.
One of the interesting places that I've been is, before I go, and speaking of fairies and also knowing about UFO incidences there, is Mackinac Island there in Michigan. They have, from my understanding, a lot of history of what they consider to be the glowing fairies. And they actually mention this on the tours that they give on Mackinac when you're going up by Arch Rock and stuff. It's really, and they say it's a massive Indian burial ground, and they see all kinds of floating lights there.
Yes.
Mackinac is... Yeah. Well, anyways, Steve, thank you for joining us. Again, folks, we'd like to say thank you to WTWW, the International Shortwave Station, for carrying us, and all of our other local affiliates. Again, folks, if you've got something that you want to disclose to us, or you want us to cover, or you think you've got somebody that you want us to interview, 1-833-880-9899, 1-833-880-9899. Follow the prompts and leave us a voicemail there. Like to say good evening. This has been Radio Disclosure. Work gets all.